Hello, this is Janice Schweizer with the Pantograph for Tuesday, June 23, 2026. We begin on the front page with Risk of Tick Illness Surges, Alpha-Gal Syndrome in Southern Illinois by Kristen Borschers and Riley Sembler with the Saluki Local Reporting Lab. Amanda Allen Hall meticulously plans every meal. She avoids restaurants. Spending time outdoors requires careful consideration, a painful reality for the former hiking enthusiast since she developed alpha-gal syndrome 8 years ago. A mere step outside leaves her at risk of an anaphylactic reaction as the threat and population of ticks increases in her own backyard. The little-known condition that changed the 45-year-old Murphy Burroughs resident's life traces back to a 2018 hike in Ware's Valley, Tennessee. During the hike, she felt a sharp sting on her leg. It was a lone star tick bite that would eventually lead to her diagnosis. "It's a whole mess," Hall said of the condition, which can trigger severe allergic reactions to red meat. "I never dreamed 20 years ago that I'd be dealing with something like this." As tick populations expand across the Midwest, a phenomenon scientists attribute to climate change, concerns about tick-borne illnesses are growing. That's especially true in southern Illinois, home to the Shawnee National Forest, where outdoor recreation and work are a way of life for many. Illinois is among the top 13 states seeing a rise in alpha-gal syndrome cases caused by a bite from the Lone Star tick, with residents living in southern Illinois at the highest risk, according to a 2025 study by the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. "We don't have enough long-term data about the population of ticks, but we do know that the number of tick-borne diseases is increasing," said Rebecca Smith, a pathobiology professor at the University of Illinois, who led the Centers for Disease Control-funded study published in the September edition of the scientific journal Ticks and Tick-Borne Diseases. The CDC estimates at least 450,000 Americans may be affected, with more than 110,000 suspected cases reported from 2010 to 2022. The CDC estimated at least 90 cases across every southern Illinois county, though that's likely an undercount. A spokesperson for the Illinois Department of Public Health said the agency does not have data on alpha-gal syndrome because they don't track the number of positive cases, unlike Lyme disease and Rocky Mountain spotted fever. Smith said many doctors still overlook alpha-gal syndrome when their patients present with common allergic symptoms, and said more education and better tracking are needed to fully understand the scope of the problem. "We are seeing an increased reporting of alpha-gal, but we're also having to inform the medical professionals that it exists and that there is a test for it," Smith said. "So it might be that it's increasing because we're getting better at diagnosing it, and we're getting people more aware of it. But also, we think that the ticks are moving." Illinois lawmakers have sought to improve data collection on alpha-gal syndrome. Last August, Governor J.B. Pritzker signed the Tracking Infectious Cases Knowledgeably Act, or TIC Act, into law, expanding on earlier efforts around Lyme disease. It requires healthcare providers to report new alpha-gal syndrome diagnoses to local health departments, which then submit the data to the Illinois Department of Public Health. It also directs IDPH to launch a statewide public awareness campaign and publish annual data on the condition. Alpha-gal is a sugar found in most mammals, excluding humans. When the sugar enters the bloodstream through a Lone Star tick bite, the body's immune system can begin treating it as a threat. As a result, people with alpha-gal syndrome may experience allergic reactions after consuming red meat and other mammal-derived products, such as dairy, medication-containing gelatin products, some skin care and household products. Even receiving heart valves from pigs or cows can trigger some people with the syndrome. Consuming chicken and fish is fine. Reactions tend to occur between 2 and 10 hours after a person consumes a mammalian product, which can make it difficult to determine the cause. Symptoms vary widely. Some experience mild discomfort, hives, flushing, nausea, and diarrhea are common. On the extreme end, the reactions can be life-threatening, as with other common food allergies like peanuts. For Hall, just the smell of red meat cooking nearby can trigger an anaphylactic reaction. It has altered her life. For many years, Hall drove semi-trucks with her husband, John. Now she tends to stay close to home, fearing how her body will react on the road if she inadvertently triggers an allergic reaction. Efforts to improve education and tracking around tick-borne diseases stem from one mother's long and frustrating fight to get answers for her sick daughter. In 2012, Jennifer Russell of Aledo heard the school bus drop off her daughter, Lauren, but she never came inside. When Russell walked outside, she found her lying in the driveway. Lauren told her that her legs just stopped working. For the next 3 years, the family searched for answers. Lauren slept 12 to 16 hours a day, frequently became ill, and lost much of her short-term memory. Doctors initially suspected leukemia. It was a very difficult time, Russell said. After 3 years, Lauren developed 3 bullseye rashes in her armpits. We were told that Lyme disease wasn't in Illinois, she said, and then our dog got Lyme disease. So that was how we finally got doctors to take it seriously. Russell said it took 4 years for her daughter to regain her health. The experience led her to found the Illinois Lyme Association, which advocates for people living with tick-borne illnesses. Her advocacy work landed her in the office of State Representative Dan Swanson, a Republican from Alpha. There's nothing like the passion of a mother with a sick child, Swanson said. We've passed several pieces of legislation together as quite a team. On January 1, 2019, the Lauren Russell Lyme Disease Prevention and Protection Act went into effect. It also created the statewide Lyme Disease Task Force. Through the task force, the pair has developed educational materials that it has provided to IDPH and hosted conferences to educate medical professionals on tick-borne illnesses and prevention. Then last year, Swanson, whose mother also has alpha-gal syndrome, expanded on those efforts, this newest law targeting alpha-gal syndrome. The Saluki Local Reporting Lab reached out to IDPH, which said it was in the process of developing educational materials for its website. It recently posted flyers online describing alpha-gal syndrome, how to avoid it, and how to manage symptoms. Additionally, IDPH has posted trailhead signage at popular hiking spots in southern Illinois, warning hikers of tick exposures in collaboration with the Illinois Lyme Association. Turning to local news, we have Camelback Bridge West College Road Work to Begin in Normal by Olivia Jacobs. Camelback Bridge and the portion of the Constitution Trail under the bridge will be closed starting at 8 a.m. Wednesday for bridge maintenance. East Virginia Avenue will be closed from Hillcrest Street to South Linden Street, and West Virginia Avenue will be closed to through traffic from Broadway to Hillcrest Street while this work is underway. The closure is expected to be completed by 5 p.m. Thursday, June 25th, weather permitting. A map of the closure can be viewed online. Normal also has a lane reduction scheduled to begin at 7 a.m. Tuesday. The outside eastbound lane on West College Avenue will be closed from its intersection with Adelaide Street to Delane Street for the sewer lining. Work is expected to be completed by 5 p.m. Tuesday, weather permitting. Drivers are encouraged to find alternate routes or to use caution when traveling through these areas. Olivia Jacobs also writes, Andy Grammer is bringing one-man show to Bloomington this November. Multi-platinum artist Andy Grammer is bringing his Greater Than Part 2, a one-man show, to Bloomington Center for the Performing Arts this fall. The show will take place at 7 p.m. Sunday, November 15th at 600 North East Street. A pre-sale will begin at 10 a.m. Thursday, June 25th, with tickets officially on sale at 10 a.m. Friday, June 26th via Ticketmaster. Doors will open at 6 p.m. The concert will feature acoustic songs on piano and guitar, as well as spoken word poetry and storytelling. He is best known for tracks like Don't Give Up on Me, Honey I'm Good, Fine by Me, and more. The show is said to be an intimate, raw, funny, and fully present high-energy performance and uplifting experience, featuring the hits, new music, and the stories behind them, according to a news release from the venue. This one-man show transforms the stage into a shared space between artist and audience, offering a rare opportunity to experience the heart of music in an up-close and unforgettable setting, the news release said. Also, Wheel of Fortune Live is coming to Bloomington. Wheel of Fortune Live is coming to the Bloomington Center for the Performing Arts this fall. The Sony Pictures Studio production will take place at 7 p.m. Wednesday, October 28th at 600 Northeast Street. A ticket presale will begin at 10 a.m. Thursday, June 25th, with tickets officially on sale at 10 a.m. Friday, June 26th via Ticketmaster. Contestants will be selected from the audience to go on stage and participate in the game show. Participants will have a chance to spin a replica of the famous wheel, call consonants, buy vowels, solve puzzles, and win prizes, including trips to Paris or Hawaii and cash prizes up to $10,000, according to a news release from the venue. You can visit artsblooming.org or wheelofortunelive.com for more information. D. Jack Alkier writes, Watson, a leader, mentor, Air Force Colonel, NCHS alumnus killed in B-52 crash. One of the eight men who died in a military plane crash last week at Edwards Air Force Base in California grew up in Normal. Colonel Gregory M. Watson, 53, was identified as one of the service members aboard a B-52 that crashed Monday, June 15th, during a routine test, according to a news release from the 412th Test Wing. Watson graduated from Normal Community High School in 1991, married Holly Weller in December 1999, and completed joint undergraduate navigator training in 2002 at Randolph Air Force Base in San Antonio, Texas. He was most recently assigned as a reservist to the 10th Air Force at Naval Air Station Joint Reserve Base, Fort Worth in Texas, and called Shreveport, Louisiana home. After the fatal crash, Watson's family confirmed the man's identified by Air Force officials was originally from Normal, but his family declined an interview request. Lieutenant Colonel Gabriel Estrella, retired Lieutenant Colonel Miles Middleton, Major Alexander Davis, Major Robert D., Major Brad Hovey, and civilians Jeremy Smith and Christopher Richard also died in the crash. These airmen were more than co-workers, said Colonel Thomas Tower, commander of the 412th Test Wing. They were friends, mentors, teammates, and valued members of our Edwards and Air Force family. Our immediate focus is supporting the families of the teammates we lost and ensuring that all appropriate resources are available to them during this time of unimaginable loss. In a Facebook post Wednesday, the 307th Bomb Wing, where Watson spent nearly a decade, offered condolences. From leading the 343rd Bomb Squadron to guiding our airmen in numerous leadership roles across the wing, he was a mentor, a leader, and a true friend to so many of us. As a command weapon systems officer with over 3,200 hours in the B-52H, his dedication to the mission was matched only by his devotion to the people he served alongside, according to the post. Our deepest thoughts, prayers, and support are with Greg's family, his friends, and the families of the seven other brave, dedicated airmen lost in this tragedy. We stand with you during this incredibly difficult time. Next, we have America in Glum Mood as 250th Birthday Nears by Susan Page with USA Today. America is not in a party mood. Even as the U.S. approaches the 250th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence, a celebration of the founding of the world's oldest modern constitutional democracy, most Americans are mired in dissatisfaction with the nation's present and pessimism about its future. By double digits in recent polls, they predict the country's best years are behind us, with more peril than promise ahead. Despite a few glimmers of good feeling, today's fierce political divisions redefined a milestone that has often been marked by unity and optimism, at least for a moment. A cover of The New Yorker by Barry Bliss portrayed a dyspeptic George Washington doused by confetti and holding a martini. The caption read, white, and kinda blue. A half dozen recent national surveys conducted by the Pew Research Center and Gallup, NBC News and Fox News, Elon University, and Emerson College pose different questions, but consistently shows an anxious nation that is nervously eyeing what will follow. That's not entirely new. In the past, the big anniversaries of the Declaration have been marked not only by celebration, but also by protest and unease. In 1876, at the centennial, the U.S. was still recovering from a devastating civil war. At the official celebration at Independence Hall in Philadelphia, suffragist Susan B. Anthony marched on stage, uninvited, to present demands for women's rights to the gathered dignitaries. In 1976, the bicentennial followed the traumas of the Vietnam War and the Watergate scandal that forced President Richard Nixon's resignation. Leading the celebration was his successor, Gerald Ford, the only president who was never elected to a national office as president or vice president. Many generations of Americans always took the founding as an opportunity to agitate for more rights, said Carol Faulkner, a historian at Syracuse University, who has studied the commemorations. This might be a time of thinking about liberty, equality, the pursuit of happiness. But in some ways, this time is different, she said. It's much more partisan. It's really much more about a divisive president than the 1876 or the 1976 commemorations. Today's mood is more downbeat, too. During the bicentennial in 1976, 43% of those surveyed by Roper felt optimistic about the future of the country, compared with 15% who were pessimistic. The positive outnumbering the negative by 28 percentage points. 39% were uncertain. Now, in an Emerson College poll that asked the same question, pessimism jumped 26 points to 41%. While optimism had ticked down to 42%. Overall, a positive edge of a single point. 18% are still uncertain. About 7 in 10 Americans, or 69%, told an Elon University poll that they believed the signers of the Declaration of Independence would feel more disappointment than pride about modern American democracy. The quincentennial comes after two tumultuous decades that upended the nation's politics and left many Americans feeling battered. The financial system melted down in 2008, and the global COVID-19 pandemic erupted in 2020. The divisive Iraq War ended in 2011, and the long Afghanistan War 10 years later with a chaotic withdrawal. Since his first election in 2016, President Donald Trump reshaped a more populist Republican Party with a harder edge. Democratic socialists like New York Mayor Zohran Mamdani and New York U.S. Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez have become more important forces in the Democratic Party. Critics accused Trump of making events marking America at 250 from the June 14th UFC cage match on the White House South Lawn to the Great American State Fair on the National Mall to be more about celebrating him than the country. The signature events in Washington on July 4th, including a supersized fireworks display, will be the most spectacular, quote, Trump rally of them all, Trump boasted on social media. While Congress created a bipartisan commission called America 250 to coordinate anniversary celebrations, Trump created a separate group called Freedom 250 that has taken the lead on the biggest ones. Concerns about his takeover of traditionally non-political celebrations led some states to decline participating in Washington events and some entertainers to cancel plans to perform at them. Even some more community-based plans have taken on a partisan tinge. In a Gallup poll taken in collaboration with America 250 and the group With Honor, almost 9 of 10 Republicans, or 88%, said they planned to mark the anniversary in some way, compared with 54% of Democrats. There are divisions by age, too. Among seniors, those 65 and older, 84% plan to celebrate. Among younger adults, those 18 to 39, 54%. On most measures, young people are more pessimistic than their elders about the future of the country and the resilience of the American dream, the aspiration that fueled generations of Americans. Younger adults in the Pew poll were more likely to predict that by the year 2050, the country would be more politically divided, less economically prosperous, and a more dangerous place to live. Among voters under 30, 3 in 10 told a Fox News poll that they would rather live in some other country. Some analysts fear that the friction over the 250th celebrations, especially the national ones, could end up reinforcing the nation's bitter divide rather than providing a respite from it. Still, almost everyone surveyed by Gallup cited something that made them most proud to be an American, topped by the freedoms we have, 35%, and the diversity of our people, 28%. Just 4% said they weren't proud of anything. Almost 9 in 10 named something that made them optimistic about the future, starting with 26% who cited people willing to stand up for what they believe is right. That said, 12% couldn't think of anything that made them optimistic. Next, we have Vance, Iran Talks Good Foundation, by Humreya Pamuk, Dave Graham, and Tala Ramadan with Reuters. U.S. Vice President J.D. Vance said Monday talks with Iranian officials in Switzerland laid a good foundation for a final peace deal, despite tensions over the Strait of Hormuz and Lebanon. The two sides, trying to build on an interim deal signed last week, agreed to a roadmap toward a permanent agreement within 60 days at the talks in the Qatari-owned Swiss mountain resort of Birkenstock, mediators Pakistan and Qatar said. They also agreed on a mechanism to end fighting in Lebanon between U.S. ally Israel and Iran-aligned Hezbollah, and open a communications line to help ensure safe passage for commercial ships through the Strait, a vital oil supply route. Vance claimed Tehran agreed to allow in nuclear inspectors and to establish mechanisms to handle its assets frozen abroad and manage ceasefires. "We laid a very good foundation for a successful final deal," he told reporters after taking part in the talks. But Iranian Foreign Ministry spokesperson Esmael Baghai told the official IRNA news agency Monday that Tehran did not negotiate on its nuclear program and did not accept any new commitments in Sunday's talks. Iran's interaction with the International Atomic Energy Agency will continue in accordance with current procedures, subject to the approval of Iran's parliament and the decisions of the Supreme National Security Council. Since the U.S. bombed Iran's nuclear facilities in June last year, Iran let the IAEA inspect only facilities that weren't attacked in those strikes. The IAEA halted inspections completely after the U.S.-Israeli strikes that began the war with Iran on February 28th, and they have not resumed since. U.S. President Donald Trump threatened Sunday to restart the war after Iran again closed the Strait of Hormuz, citing Washington's failure to halt the fighting in Lebanon. Iranian Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi said on social media that Tehran secured waivers for oil and petrochemical exports, the release of some of its frozen assets abroad, and the launch of a reconstruction and development plan for Iran. Vance said White House envoy Jared Kushner, Trump's son-in-law, came up with a process where the U.S. and Qatar would have control over Iranian funds when they are unfrozen that would allow the money to be spent on U.S. corn, soy, and wheat. The U.S. Treasury Department issued a general license for Iran on Monday, authorizing the production, delivery, and sale of crude oil and petrochemical and petroleum products of Iranian origin through August 21st. Technical talks were due to continue for the rest of this week, and Pakistani Prime Minister Shehbaz Sharif wrote on social media that the first round of talks concluded successfully. The discussions were held in a positive and constructive atmosphere and yielded encouraging progress, he said. Oil prices rose sharply when Tehran started blocking the Strait of Hormuz, prompting a U.S. blockade of Iranian ports, but fell after last week's interim deal to their lowest since the war began. Oil prices dipped further after Monday's joint statement by Qatar and Pakistan, with worries about a supply shortage in global markets easing and global benchmark Brent crude trading below $80 a barrel. Before Sunday's talks officially began, Fox News quoted Trump as saying he had told Iranian officials, "You won't have a country," if they tried to close the strait again. Iran's semi-official Tasnim news agency, citing an informed source, said that after Trump's threats became public, the Iranian delegation refused to return to the room where talks were held, though messages were traded via the mediators. The Memorandum of Understanding calls for reopening the Strait of Hormuz and ending all hostilities, including in Lebanon, where violence continued despite a ceasefire declared on Friday. Accusing the U.S. of failing to meet its commitment to halt fighting in Lebanon, Iran said at the weekend that it again stopped maritime traffic through the strait. But ship tracking data showed two crude tankers with just under 2 million barrels of oil sailed through the strait on Monday, a sign that traffic is picking up again, even though the sailings through Hormuz are still a fraction of the average daily crossings of 125 vessels before the war began. Thousands of people have been killed in the U.S.-Israeli war against Iran, mostly in Iran and Lebanon, where Hezbollah opened fire in support of Iran on March 2nd. The violence in Lebanon abated since late Saturday, with security sources saying Israel's last airstrike was on Saturday evening. Lebanese President Joseph Aoun discussed efforts to maintain the ceasefire and halt Israeli military escalation during a phone call with Vance, Qatar's prime minister, and Kushner, the Lebanese presidency said. Israeli President Isaac Herzog and Israel said Israel was not opposed to a diplomatic end to the Iran war, but any agreement must ensure that Tehran cannot use funds it receives as part of the deal for military purposes or to support regional proxies. And for something different, we have Today in History. Tuesday, June 23rd, 1926, the College Entrance Examination Board first administered the Scholastic Aptitude Test, or SAT, for prospective college students. In 1969, retiring U.S. Supreme Court Chief Justice Earl Warren swore in Warren Burger to be the 15th Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. In 1970, political newcomer Charles Rangel defeated civil rights activist and incumbent U.S. Representative Adam Clayton Powell Jr. in the Democratic primary for a district that includes the neighborhood of Harlem, New York, ending the political career of one of the major political symbols of the post-World War II period. In 1972, President Richard Nixon signed into law Title IX of the Civil Rights Act, which banned discrimination based on sex in education programs and activities that get federal financial funding. Also, in 1972, President Richard Nixon and H.R. Haldeman, his chief of staff, were recorded in the Oval Office on what became known as the Smoking Gun Tape. They talked about using the guise of a national security to have the CIA urge the FBI to halt its investigation into the source of money found on burglars after a break-in 6 days prior at the Democratic National Committee headquarters in the Watergate building. And with that, we complete the reading of Part 1 of the Pantograph for Tuesday, June 23rd, 2026. I'm Janice Schweizer, and I will return shortly with Part 2.